Good morning, everyone. I am impressed that so many people got up this early. I think that's pretty impressive. On April 28th, 1967, I got married. I don't know if all of you have gone through that lovely thing. I suspect Militsa has not, but if you've gone through the sacrament of marriage, you suddenly go from a place where ultimately you're just responsible for yourself to a place where suddenly you have someone else who is depending on you for support, who is depending on you for assistance, and who is looking to you, as you perceive it anyway, to earn enough money to keep her living at the level to which she will very quickly become accustomed. Well, by June of 1967, it was also pretty clear that there were going to be three of us in the family. So not only was I married, but I now had the prospect of becoming a father. That's a pretty daunting prospect for someone who had been away from any training or any direction or any notion of how to behave as a blind person since essentially the age of 13. So it was a pretty scary time for me because, in addition to all of those things, I was just finishing a master's degree in international relations and had been informed by the State Department that it really didn't matter to them how qualified I was. As long as my eyes didn't work, I didn't either. So my intention, which was to become either a foreign service officer or a foreign policy specialist in the Department of State, and I wanted to specialize in countries that dared to be non-aligned, because I kind of thought they were the most interesting countries to work with, was not happening. So there I was, kid on the way, wife panting at the breath, at waiting for me to demonstrate that I had the capacity to win bread, and I had about enough bread to rub copper together. And in Trinidad at that time, there were stereotypes of blindness that were really pretty different from the stereotypes that we have here. In this country, there are some expectations, and there even were then, as people like Oral and Otis can indicate, there were expectations that that folks could get jobs, even if they were in sheltered workshops, or even if they were in vending, or even if they were in schools for the blind. Blind folks could get jobs. And that's not to say that any of those jobs are demeaning, by the way. It's just to talk about stereotypes. In Trinidad, there was a workshop for the blind, which is not a government-run entity, but was put together by a private charity that mostly received funding from folks who felt sorry for all those blind folks. And the primary task of the workshop for the blind in Trinidad was to do kind of pre-industrial work. And I suspect Mr. Tanby could tell us something about that from way back when. But anyway, the other issue that I faced was an issue of confidence. And I don't know if any of you have ever been there, but it's one thing to be successful in a college environment, and it's another thing to suddenly put your theoretical knowledge on the line and to put your capacity to survive in a classroom on the line as a teacher. And I don't know how any of you who were teachers felt on your first day when you went into a classroom, but I can tell you, at least from my perspective, that I was scared to death. And I went from school to school in Trinidad, and you know, by that time I had what was called a special honors degree in history, which is a fancy title for meaning that the degree was a more specialized degree than most. And I had a B+ average, which was a tribute to the fact that I actually worked in the third year instead of drinking, which I'd done for the first two. And I also had a graduate degree in international relations. So I thought I was in good shape. I mean, you know, I had all the qualifications, more qualifications than virtually anybody else who was applying to be a teacher. So I was good to go. They'd hire me, right? No, absolutely not. Well, in Trinidad, there is an exam called the 11 plus exam. And that exam is a frightening thing because it is one of the ways that it's one of the ways that class is retained in the Caribbean. The 11 plus exam determines who goes to high school. Those who don't pass the 11 plus exam have a few more years of education, but there is no expectation that the kids who don't pass the 11 plus exam will ever go to college. The 11 plus exam then is an important exam, and it is taken between the ages of 11 and 12 by kids, and most of the kids in the middle classes and the upper classes get extra tutoring before the exam happens, and they go to elite primary schools and they pass. Most of the poorer kids in Trinidad are in very underfunded primary schools, and it's very hard for them to prepare for this exam, so many fail. That created a place for some very underfunded secondary schools that would enable some of the more able kids whose parents could scrape together extra money could go to school and learn the skills that they needed to take an alternate exam to the exams that high school kids took that would eventually allow them to get high school certification and then go on to college or university. And the school that I eventually found a job at was called St. Charles School for Girls. So I not only found myself having to teach, by the way, I was earning a princely salary of $300 per month, and the Trinidadian dollar, at that point was, you'd get about four Trinidadian dollars for every US one. So I was essentially working for about 75 bucks a month. And I suddenly found myself required to go into this classroom. Oh, and by the way, I'm sorry, sir, but we don't have any teaching posts available for history, so you're going to teach English and geography, okay? Sure, fine, right. And the truth is, I didn't know if I could do it. I had no idea, and when I would apply for jobs during my first summer in Trinidad, what I would essentially say to folks, look, I'm not sure I'm going to be the greatest teacher in the world. I've never tried teaching before, but I promise you, you won't have to fire me. If I can't do it, I'll walk away. It's not a problem. I won't stay here and do a bad job. You don't have to worry about that. Yeah, right, sir. Uh-huh. Once we get you in that school, you're never going to leave, and then we're never going to be able to get rid of you. And we're going to have this blind idiot on our hands who can't teach anything. I don't think so. Well, I don't know how to describe the first day that I went to the classroom, except to say that I had no notion of how I was going to do it, and essentially no real idea of how one was supposed to teach either. And this particular school, I don't know who made the rules for it. It was run by a Catholic outfit, and the book that I was required to teach to the fifth form still sticks in my mind. It is one of the more unusual books by a novelist who I have never been able to like very much, named Thomas Hardy. And the name of the book is The Woodlanders. I don't know if anybody has ever read that book. But it is not one of my favorite books. And it is an absolutely appalling book to try to teach to young girls, because at the very heart of that book is a very different sort of romance than most good Catholic girls in the fifth form are supposed to be discussing. So, you know, the kids in the classroom used to absolutely revel in making Mr. Edwards blush, you know. Mr. Edwards, excuse me, sir, but could you tell me why it is the girl always wanting to do those sorts of things with the guy? I don't understand, sir. Mr. Edwards, what that phrase mean? What is that about? I don't understand what they mean by kissing in the shadows. What is that? So, for a year, I taught girls in St. Charles School. And in a lot of respects, I've got to tell you, it was one of the most wonderful experiences that I ever had. And I'll tell you why. Every single one of the kids who was in that school wanted to be there. And they knew that their parents were sacrificing to get them an education. They wanted to succeed. They knew they had to succeed if they were going to move ahead with their lives. For the first time, and really in lots of respects for the last time in all of my teaching career that year, I had students who really wanted to learn. That's wonderful. The next year, I went to work for the largest, in Trinidad it's called an Anglican school, but of course in this country that would be reread as Episcopal, called Trinity College. And I got the job as the chief history master for this relatively prestigious, really quite prestigious, high school in the Caribbean, where I taught for the next 9 years. But the next 9 years of teaching weren't nearly as wonderful as the first year, because the first year was not only a year when I knew kids wanted to learn, but I also discovered that I could teach them. I can't tell you what an enlivening and exciting experience it is to discover that you really can be successful. I cannot tell you how glorious it was at the end of the year to see about 90 or 95% of the kids in my class in English pass the national exam set through the University of London and be qualified in English. It was like somebody had made me Santa Claus and the Easter Bunny and a little tiny angel, an imp who could jump up and down all at once, because kids who I had come to care for, kids who had become my friends and people who I loved in a good and appropriate way suddenly were successful, parents would come up to me at the end of the year and say, you know, when you came to this school, we wasn't sure if you was going to be able to teach our kids okay, but you know, you are right, man. You are right. For the next 9 years, the kids who I taught tended to be kids from the middle classes or the upper classes. There were a few kids who got scholarships. Some kids, because it was becoming more. But it was a turbulent time to be teaching in Trinidad, because Trinidad had just become independent. And remember what I was teaching? I was teaching history, and I was teaching West Indian history at the very time when the government and many of the people in Trinidad were interested in rewriting history. History is a malleable and pliable subject, whatever people may tell you. History is supposed to be true, but the reality is that history is each individual's notion of what is true about what happened in the past. It changes from generation to generation, from government to government, from country to country, from race to race. And it changes depending on what the current notion of reality happens to be in the society in which you're operating. And in the society in which I was operating, one of the realities was all of the problems of the island of Trinidad and all of the problems of the third world were created by the obnoxious, horrendous, debilitating colonial experience that folks had been put through by those mean, ugly, obnoxious British colonizers and their American partners. Well, I thought, I really did, that instead of building the history of a new country on negativity, folks in the developing world ought to acknowledge and value and build upon the culture that had survived in spite of colonialism. And that's what I tried to encourage the kids who I taught history to do. And it was a wonderful time in terms of conflict, because they had been taught propaganda, and luckily, I need to say this because it's important, and I'm almost done. Luckily, in Trinidad, teachers are pretty well respected. If a teacher gets a kid in trouble, the expectation is pretty strong that that kid is not only going to get it at school, but he's going to get it at home as well. And he's not only going to get it because of what he did wrong, he's also going to get it because he disrespected the teacher. I am sad that in this country, teachers do not have that same respect. In the 9 years that I taught, I really only had one major discipline problem, and that came about on a day when I challenged a kid in the fifth form for not doing his homework. He didn't appreciate it. He pulled a knife and threw it at my head. He missed. But it is an indication of how different the notion of what a teacher's responsibility is in a country like Trinidad, that for the next 5 afternoons after school, that kid and I were alone together in a room while he finished his homework. And I wouldn't have it any other way. One other quick story, and then I'm going to stop and let people ask questions. Here's the deal. I used to pray on the first day of every school year, particularly with younger kids, with the kids in the first and second form, which is the 11 and 12 year olds, that somebody would misbehave in the back of the classroom. I used to pray for it because I had pretty good hearing, and so I used to always love it when kids would drop a coin, you know? Because everybody sat in the same seat. So I would say something like, "Oh, John Smith, Mr. Smith, you dropped a shilling, man." And the kids would look at, "Oh man, we can't fool around with this guy because Jesus, he knows everything about where we are, you know? He seems blind, but he can see, man. I ain't going to mess with him." But the other reason why I think you're successful as a teacher, if you are, and I guess I was because they didn't fire me. The other reason why you're successful as a teacher is because you love your subject and you love to teach, and you engage your students. I don't think I could ever have been a successful disciplinarian, but what I could do and what I did do and what made me proud when I did it was I could persuade a lot of the kids in my classroom that history mattered. And if we can do that in everything that we do, whatever our job is, if we can persuade those around us that our job matters, and that the subject matter that we're involved with matters, we have the capacity to not only impact the folks who are immediately around us, but a much larger world, because we send a message to everyone who sees us and watches us that says, the job I do is important, but more importantly, the job I can do and will do enables those who look at me to establish that their stereotypes and values and notions of what blindness and blind people are about as bogus as the kind of propaganda that's practiced either by colonizers or by the Third World. So, ladies and gentlemen, I guess I would leave you with this one thought. As teachers, you have a gift and an honor. And all of us who have taught, if we are really good at what we do, not only have we taught, but the kids learned too. Thank you.
Leaving for some meeting.
No, Marcia and I have our next meeting together.
Paul, I have a question. Carla Hayes.
Yes, Ms. Carla.
And by the way, very good presentation.
Thank you.
And I always enjoy hearing from you. My question is, I've always been, when I do a lot of work with foreign countries and foreigners, and I like to compare notes about how are blind people treated, perceived, and services for the blind in different countries. So what is it like to be someone who is blind or visually impaired in Trinidad? What kind of services do they have in general? What kind of attitudes do they have?
Well, we should really ask Ramesh, too, because maybe he would like to add something. But I guess what I would say is it depends upon, very much upon, how much money your family has. If your family has lots of money, they will usually hire somebody who will look after you and stay with you, and you'll have a chauffeur and he'll take you around to where you need to be, and everything's kind of cool. But if you don't, then you're fortunate in lots of respects because you learn more skills, I think, than we expect blind kids to learn here. Because there isn't the infrastructure of services. You know, I mean, part of me is very glad that I was outside of this country when I did rehab, and my rehab counselor was me, because there wasn't anybody else. Ramesh, do you agree with that?
Yeah,
No? Tell us.
He's asking about, do you agree with what he said about services for
blind? Yeah, in Trinidad.
Yeah, I think sometimes you need to kind of that. Like, for example, we don't have structured mobility and yet be able to go away.
Yeah, and so you end up having to learn it nevertheless because you don't want to stay home, right, Ramesh?
We use all our own techniques.
Exactly. Oh, sure you do. But it gets you there, Brad. And the other thing that you do a lot of times is you become very friendly with other people. Hey, man, can I go with you? Another question?
Paul, in general, do you know if visually impaired people are taught in the class, in regular classrooms, or is there a special school in the Caribbean or in Trinidad?
There are schools for the blind in many countries in the Caribbean. There was one in Trinidad. And there was one in Jamaica. At the School for the Blind in Trinidad, I actually, while I was at university and even afterwards, did quite a lot of work with some of the students, just because I wanted to give back. And I think that in some respects the education that blind kids got in schools for the blind where generally blind kids went was probably better than it has become later as mainstreaming has reared its ugly head in the Caribbean. I don't think that mainstreaming is a good idea in this country, and it's an even worse idea in the third world.
Paul?
Yep.
Paul, this is Oral Bell.
Yes, sir.
A couple of quick questions. You might want to ask the opinion of Mimi Tereska there with you.
Yep.
As many of the people here may know, Mimi is an intern doing an internship at the Scripps Howard Journalism Foundation. And I'll throw in, by the way, she's the newest member of the American Council of the Blind through the District of Columbia Council of the Blind. And Mimi is from Macedonia. Probably would be in the category you just described, Paul.
Yep.
The youngsters who have to tough it out and get the things done and learn the things that are not provided by the system. And you obviously know her very well. Would you think that would describe the kind of situation you're talking about in the area?
Sure. To a degree, I don't think any developing country can avoid this. At the same time as you have to tough it out and you have to find your own approach, there are two things. You are still operating in a society where the prejudice against blind people is much greater than the prejudice, or at least the conscious prejudice in this country. I remember that, and Oral, you were there, that when we were in Egypt, one of the things that I had kind of taken for granted was regarded as a big deal, in that when some of the first representatives of blind organizations in the Caribbean Council of the Blind, were at the World Blind Union meeting, and I got a chance to meet some of them, many of those folks said to me, you know, you're kind of our hero because you were the first to go through university and to prove that we could do it. And after you were successful, they couldn't tell us no. Now, that's no credit to me, I promise you, but it is an indication of the fact that while Oral is certainly right, there's a lot of scuffling that has to happen. There's also immense ceilings that are very low for folks who are blind in developing countries.
How prevalent is the attitude in developing countries or different parts of the world that blindness is a punishment, that the parents sinned, you know, it's kind of a retribution by the Almighty for wrongs that have been done?
Well, I'm not sure if it's a developing notion. I think it may be a religious, not religious notion. You know, there are an awful lot of parents in this country who have blind kids who truly believe that it is a punishment from God and an indication of past sin when their kid is born blind. I'm not sure that's a development issue. I think a more prevalent notion of parents is more direct and more meaningful, and that is, this is not going to be an individual who I can count on to be a breadwinner. So do we allow this kid to survive? Do we spend a lot of effort and capital educating this kid when essentially he or she is not likely to contribute much? Yep.
This is Susan Shoulder. And
hi there.
Hi. My question concerns, I know you mentioned this in School for the Blind, the state of Braille literacy in Trinidad and the state of, you know, providing ways of being able to acquire.
Well, yep. It's really an interesting question. There are three factors. First, where do we find money in a country where there isn't any to buy Braille books? Especially when, for the most part, the entities that are providing services are non-government. The answer is, what we end up with are cast-offs from other countries in terms of Braille books. But the cool thing is that those cast-offs tend to be really cool books. But the third issue is, because there's not money for complex services, or there's only recently becoming some, there's no talking books. So most blind people who become literate actually, for the most part, are Braille readers. Yeah, and they're cool books. I mean, I had an opportunity to read not a lot of modern novels when I was in Jamaica and Trinidad, but I certainly had my chance at the classics, particularly the British ones. Yeah, absolutely. Lots of Thomas Hardy. I became sick to death of Tess. One, or maybe one last question, if there is one. Go ahead.
Anything we can do to help some people in Trinidad? The blind people?
Oh, well, I mean, clearly there continues to be, and maybe Oral can add to my answer, but clearly there continues to be, I think, a dichotomy in terms of how people operate in the Caribbean. Because really, the Caribbean Council of the Blind, which is a hybrid organization, it's not. It sounds like it ought to be ACB's brother. Well, it isn't quite, because they also provide services as well as being a consumer organization. But the net result is, folks want to be independent, so they don't want to see any assistance that can be offered as in any way suggesting that they ought in the least be expected to regard your gift as anything but a gift. And I think there continues to be a need for more Braille books and magazines. There continues to be a need for cassettes. Continues to be a need for slates and styluses, Braille writers. All of the stuff that you need for the infrastructure of providing a good educational environment is needed in every third world country, and none of the Caribbean islands are any different. Oral, do you agree with that?
That's a good appraisal.
Ladies and gentlemen, thank you so much for your attention.